You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb of the television. Hello, Daniel.
How's it going?
Good.
Buffalo.
Good. How
long
are you?
Long time no speak. Long time no see. I mean, I didn't really see you. I glimpsed you occasionally on stampeding over the horizon once or twice at the tour.
Dust billowing around me. Well, exactly. We had a conversation in the press room one day, you'll recall.
Oh, I've forgotten that.
I mean, right at the end, was it not?
Oh, yes.
Come on.
Yes.
Yeah, but no, I mean, you were very busy, and you were obviously in your own little Daniel bubble, television bubble, to some extent, weren't you?
Yeah, that feels slightly like a slightly barbed comment, but yeah.
Not at all. But you were in a
general comment. You know, general comment about the way I live my life.
No, but
you know, probably accurate.
No. I saw a few of your. Do they call them pieces to camera? Is that the?
I don't really know.
Is that the terminology?
I mean, 5 years on, I still feel like a bit of a novice.
Someone asked you why all your pieces to camera start with you walking uphill. I saw.
True. I just do what the cameraman tells me, and I hope he does what the director tells me. So, yeah.
Well, it looked excellent. No, but what I meant by that was that we were in slightly different places, and at this year's tour, everybody was in their place, weren't they, really? And there wasn't a lot of moving from your place. Where's Lionel?
That's a very good question. I was hoping you could tell me that.
Well, he's at home and not Watford, but he's otherwise detained today, unfortunately. So he's not able to join us. He was going to join us, but something's come up. Is detained the right word?
I thought he'd been arrested.
Well, no, he's under quarantine. So the possibility of that is not to be discounted. But he is certainly observing strict rules of quarantine, and. But he's got some family responsibilities today, so unfortunately he cannot join us. But we're going to look back on the Tour de France, aren't we? And we're going to talk briefly about the time trial yesterday and look forward to the road race tomorrow before, next week it all kind of kicks off again with the Giro. And we'll tell you a little bit later about what we're going to do over the Giro and the Vuelta. But I should do a news roundup, I suppose, with Lionel. Not here, but actually, Daniel, where are you? I should ask as well. First of all,
I am Rich. I'm near Alba in Italy, so Barolo country. I'm having a little holiday actually, before the Giro.
Very nice.
So I'm going to be here for the next few days. Going to be heading into the mountains in a couple of days, and then on Friday, in fact, I'll be flying down from Milan to Palermo, COVID permitting. But all looking pretty good and under control at the moment as far as the Giro is concerned.
Yeah, well, I'll see you in Palermo, but we'll get on to that. Well, first of all, a bit of news before we get on to the Worlds. Team Ineos have confirmed their lineup for 2021. Well, they haven't confirmed who's leaving, but joining are Richie Porte, third in the Tour de France, of course, Laurens De Ploes, Danny Martinez from EF Pro Cycling, and Tom Pidcock. De Ploes was a surprise to me. He's coming from Jumbo-Visma, very good climber. Pidcock, not so much of a surprise. Danny Martinez, I mean, that's been rumoured, but a bit of a surprise because he was under contract with EF Pro Cycling. Do you know what's happened there, Daniel?
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't think I'm breaking news to many people when I tell them that his agent is Giuseppe Acquadoro, who we've spoken about on numerous occasions over the last couple of years, Italian agent who has most of the top Colombians in his client portfolio and has a growing influence, a big influence at Ineos. And he was the agent also behind the Ivan Sosa move when Ivan Sosa, before his contract was up with Andrea?
Well, it was more that he was snatched from under the noses of Trek Segafredo, who had paid 100,000 euros or something, hadn't they, to get his signature, and then he didn't sign. Yeah.
He was all, Acquadoro was also Egan Bernal's agent. Just incidentally, Rich, if people might have seen a few snippets of news this week on Superman, Miguel Angel Lopez, who is on the move from Astana. They're not going to keep him, apparently. Well, I don't think they even made him an offer because of budgetary constraints. But he's one Colombian who's not managed by Acuadro, and he's been linked, Chiro has been linking him with AG2R this week, which would be an interesting one. I mean, that team has had mixed success with sort of Spanish and its predecessors have had mixed success with Spanish and Latin American riders. So remember, a long time ago, Francisco Mancebo rode for that team, and he was caught up in Operación Puerto. And then more recently, of course, Carlos Betancourt.
That's right.
How can we forget that? Yeah, but Superman would be a good fit in the sense that they need a GC leader. The Movistar, we thought, might be an option because, as we know, Movistar have this self-imposed veto on Acuadro riders, and Superman is not one. So we thought that could be an option. But, of course, Superman was not very complimentary about Movistar in last year's Vuelta, was he?
Oh, that's right. There was a bit of beef, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. The other name that I'd throw in there, and this is a little bit of dot joining, but Superman's agent is Giovanni Lombardi. He used to be the lead out man, Mario Cipollini. And Giovanni has very, very good contacts, a very close connection with the UAE team. And I can see them, well, being in the market for more climbers and possibly even a second sort of GC leader, with Pog, obviously, the main man now.
AG2R fairly shedding their French skin, aren't they, if they bring Lopez in as well. But as you say, they've got quite a long tradition of trying that, at least. Other news, Annemiek van Vleuten, who broke her wrist in a crash at the Giro Rosa, is going to line up for the women's road race. That's later today. Now, we will be covering that in the next episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, which will come out on Monday, and it will feature Lizzie Banks' Giro Rosa diaries. In the women's time trial on Thursday, Chloe Dygert, the defending champion, had a terrible crash, went over a road barrier. It looked awful. She suffered serious lacerations to her leg, and apparently will make a full recovery, say USA Cycling, but obviously terrible injury for her. Anna van der Breggen,
You might know this. Just watching it struck me, and just hearing a little bit, and I haven't gone back and looked exactly what the injury was at the time, but it struck me as quite similar to Wout van Aert's injury in the Tour de France last year. And a sort of similar way it happened as well. Dygert's crash, sort of smashing into kind of metal barriers. And there as well, it was more, I think the concern with van Aert was more about sort of tendons and maybe ligaments rather than broken bones.
Well, if she wants some inspiration and encouragement, look at Wout van Aert. Neil Rogers, our colleague, was also comparing it to Taylor Finney's crash when he collided with when a motorbike collided with him, I should say, in the US Championships a few years ago. It's a terrible crash, but as I say, there seems to be confidence that she will make a full recovery. Anna van der Breggen won the gold medal in the women's time trial ahead of Marlen Reuser and Ellen van Dijk. And then in the men's time trial on Friday, it was Filippo Ganna of Team Ineos Grenadier who won 26 seconds. I mean, it was a short course. The men and the women both did a 31.7-kilometre course. The wind was quite a big factor, but Ganna, the minute he went through the first time check, he looked like he was doing a different sport almost. I mean, he looks like a pure time trial specialist. He's a fantastic pursuiter. I've seen him pursuiting, and again, very, very kind of striking to watch. He's got a great position and looks like he puts out sheer power, really. Wout van Aert was second in the men's time trial, 26 seconds down, and Stefan Kung was third at 29 seconds. Geraint Thomas, who did a strong ride, was fourth at 37 seconds without his Garmin. He lost his Garmin.
What did you make of that, Buff? I saw, well, obviously it had been sort of chopped and maybe slightly cynically packaged into a headline, making out that was Thomas's main or only excuse for not winning, that he didn't have his Garmin. But he obviously was pretty aggrieved.
I doubt it was a reason for him not winning, but he may well. These guys get so used, I think, to that, having that information, that to go into a time trial, such an important time trial, without it, might have been slightly distracting and off-putting, I can imagine. I can imagine other...
It'd be tough going for a run without Strava.
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, honestly. Exactly. Probably all been victims, or a lot of us have been victims of the Garmin outages recently. And when your ride doesn't upload, it's very frustrating. That's a bit different, of course. But I think other riders would have been more put off by it. I'm wondering about Rohan Dennis, who was fifth, by the way. He was defending champion, of course. But Rohan Dennis, how he might have responded to that, that might have been quite different.
There's no suggestion there was a Garmin thief on the loose who took Dennis's as well. What's that?
Is that why
Napalm's been banged up?
No, he's not been snaffling Garmin's. I can imagine, though, you know, for a time trial where, you know, it's all about trying to measure your effort, not having that information could really put you off. But I mean, I don't know, Geraint Thomas, you know, came out very aggressively and went through that first check and really looked like he was, you know, setting a mark that might be difficult to beat. And in the end, he was fourth, as I say. And the first sort of eight riders were separated by 52 seconds. But Ganna, you know, 26 seconds ahead of Van Aert, was really a very deserving winner. It was, as I say, very windy course. He went out very fast into the headwind and then kind of held on, although didn't lose much, to be honest. Averaged 52.9 kilometres an hour. And he is the first ever Italian winner of the men's time trial, the World Championship, which I found quite a remarkable statistic.
It is, really, when you consider that there were all those years, sort of, well, particularly the 90s and then the 2000s, when Italy really dominated the road race and had more pros than any other nation and were really the number one superpower in professional cycling, yet in that period never really looked like winning the World Time Trial Championship. I think they picked up, if our memory serves, they picked up the odd medal. But yeah, now they've really been relegated. I mean, at the Tour de France, it struck me once again how small the Italian influence has become. I mean, I go to the Tour de France now and barely speak Italian for the whole 3 weeks, which was not the case many years ago. But yeah, it's a bit of an anomaly that against that backdrop, all of a sudden they've got the best time trialist in the world. And also someone who, I mean, I think we've all been waiting for the next real dominant time trialist to emerge, the guy who's maybe going to win three or four world titles. You know, Dennis has looked like that at times, but it now looks set to be Ganna for the next 3 or 4 years, I would suggest.
Well,
certainly, if the
yeah.
course is relatively flat.
Yeah, it reminds me of Cancellara, Fabian Cancellara, a little bit in sort of build and style. And, you know, when Cancellara was in full flight in a time trial, again, he looked like he was doing a different sport to everybody else. But, you know, how quickly things change. You know, only last year when Dennis won, he looked like the dominant time trial, particularly the circumstances which he won last year, having, you know, not raced for a bit. And then this year he fades to fifth. But Ganna, he looks like a sort of specialist. He's 24 now. He hasn't ridden a Grand Tour, but he will, we expect, make his Grand Tour debut at the Giro. And that opening time trial, the Lionel Burney stage, the downhill time trial into Palermo, looks...
The cheese roll.
Looks made for him.
Pretty much.
He should win that, shouldn't he?
Yes, you would think so, yeah.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, iWalker. Very grateful to them for their support. If you run a small business or know somebody who does and you want to know what iWalker can do to help you, go to iwalker.co.uk. Lots of information there about the loans that they offer, and including the coronavirus business interruption loan scheme, and some changes this week to that in terms of how long that will run. So go to iwalker.co.uk. Now, Daniel, we're catching up and looking back a little bit at the Tour de France. Shall we hear, first of all, actually, from our Pedler de Charme, Richie Port? He was voted by you the Pedler de Charme. I think a lot of people really got behind Richie Port at this year's Tour de France. You know, he's been trying for years to finish on the podium, has had a lot of bad luck, And he had bad luck this year as well that he had to overcome. So people really, I think, got behind him, and a lot of neutrals were quite happy when he ended up on the podium in the time trial. And he was voted our Pedler de Charme for the Tour de France. I think also for the way that he conducted himself and the fact that he was absent for the birth of his baby daughter. So we're arranging for a mug, a one-off mug made by Stacey Snyder to be sent to Richie Port. And we got in touch with him this week just to tell him the great news. And here's what he said.
G'day to all the listeners to the Cycling Podcast. Hey, thanks so much for voting for me in the, excuse my terrible French, but Pedler de Charme. I really appreciate the vote. It's been quite the journey for me in the Tour to end up on the podium. Obviously, you all kind of know my story, the bad luck and dramas and everything that's gone along with it. So I really appreciate, you know, a lot of people can identify with that. And yeah, it was a great 3 weeks, and thank you for all the support. It's very much appreciated, and thanks, keep listening.
So that was a very grateful Richie Port, and we're grateful to him for sending us that message when it must have been a busy week. Maybe he was just escaping for a bit from the newborn, I don't know. But thanks very much to Richie Port, and thanks to all of you who voted him our Pedler de Charme. Daniel, did you speak a lot to Richie Port over the course of the Tour?
Yes, I did, Rich, and I think everyone was thrilled for him on the, well, after the time trial on the Saturday when he finally secured that third place. It didn't look as though it was going to happen, and this sort of narrative has been built around Richie, and I think, you know, at times he's felt it as well, that he's always going to be, or he's doomed, he's condemned to be pursued by bad luck and misfortune, and he's never quite going to live up to maybe people's unrealistic expectations. And yeah, I think he's ended up absorbing some of that, even if you know, he's known what he could achieve at any given time, and he's been proud of his career, rightly so. But you know, he can't be deaf to what people are saying about him and what people have said about his career. So I think you know, that has brought its own pressure, and I just felt that you know, he made the statement of I think at the start of the Tour, around about the start of the Tour, where he sort of called time on his GC ambitions, and he said, this is going to be my last Tour as a, or my last Grand Tour as a GC leader. And you know, with Richie, you've always felt that when he's relaxed, he is undeniably one of the best three or four climbers in the world, and an excellent time trialist. So talent wise he's got everything to be contending for Grand Tours. But what has maybe tripped him up at times has been, you know, the stress and the pressure. And you know, it was almost as though he'd made that statement before the Tour, and, you know, let out a bit of a sigh of relief that, you know, he didn't have to put himself under that pressure anymore. And he was consequently relaxed going into the Tour, and he took that spirit into the Tour, and then we finally saw what his actual level is. And really, he rode an absolutely flawless race, you know, including on the last Alpine stage, when it looked as though, you know, the old kind of demons and the old misfortune was coming back to haunt him, when he had the puncture on the gravel section. And and you know, he managed to keep a cool head in that situation. Didn't get a lot of help from the riders that were with him at the time, but he repaired the damage. And yeah, that was the kind of thing, that was the kind of scenario where in the past you feel he might have been tripped up. So it was just, you know, it was a heartwarming story of this Tour, Richie Port getting third place. And, you know,
it was, yeah.
And one that inevitably raises questions about whether he's wrong to call time on those GC ambitions.
Well, but I'm wondering what ambitions I can call time on in order to finally fulfill them. I'm going to call time on my ambition to turn pro. How about that?
I thought you were going to say something.
Or something else.
To write
an award-winning book. Yeah. I don't know, another award-winning book. Moving on from Richie Port, I mean the Tour more generally. How did you find it? I mean, there were, as we said, all these restrictions. It was a strange Tour, in so many ways. But as a you do your famous wine glass rating. I think you gave this one a four. out of 5 wine glass rating. So it was obviously pretty good. But, you know, digging into that a bit more deeply, what are your thoughts and impressions at the end of the race?
I mean, I thought that the route ended up being very interesting. You know, the first week, we all talked about the first week and the effect that the early mountains would have on the race. And at the time, maybe it didn't seem as though, you know, it had the sort of crash bang wallop effect that we all hoped for. But, you know, there were a lot of interesting sort of subtle things that were happening in that first week, and a lot of sort of storylines were being set up for later in the race. So, you know, the crashes, obviously, on day one, they really conditioned the GC battle as well, with things like Pino crashing and really eliminating him from the GC battle. And even down to George Bennett crashing on the first stage, and that depriving Jumbo-Visma of yet another, you know, very strong mountain domestique. And, you know, who knows what difference that might have made. Obviously, they were the dominant team, but with an extra guy in there, they might have found a way to put more riders to the sword earlier. So that was really interesting. And then I thought the sprint stages were interesting, as they have been for the last few years, because there isn't a real alpha sprinter yet, I don't think, in this generation. I think there are a lot of really good ones who are very closely matched. But you can still have, you know, Wout van Aert, who's not a pure sprinter, competing with them. Whatever people say about Sagan not being the force he was in sprints, I mean, he's still right up there. So, you know, it's really close. And, you know, there are days when Ewan just looks as though he's going to, you know, become that supreme force, and he's going to become unbeatable, but it's not been the case thus far. So I thought they were really interesting. And the one thing I thought the race just lacked, from a purely view of being, you know, kind of really critical of just the drama levels and the narrative, would be sort of periods of an hour or 2 hours in mountain stages where there was real suspense, where you really it felt as though the race could turn either way. There was never really, I think there was a hierarchy of the top 10 riders that were very, very closely matched, but I thought you pretty much saw that hierarchy emerging in the last sort of half hour of every mountain stage, and it was pretty much always the same. So it became a quite a tactical, perhaps didn't seem that tactical, because there weren't many teams or riders trying many different things, but it was a game of sort of subtle moves and counter moves, but nothing that really threatened to turn the race on its head at any point. I don't know if you'd agree.
No, I mean, I suppose the Col de la Loz was the moment where we thought we were seeing the pecking order confirmed, I guess. You know, that moment when Roglic distanced Pogacar a little bit, and really for the only time in the mountains, and he looked like he was swinging a bit, and Pogacar was coming back, and then he sort of settled into his rhythm again. But looking back now, and we're looking, you know, inevitably you look back at the whole race, knowing what happened in the end, and for all that Roglic looked really secure, and that was probably in large part because of his team being so strong, he never really looked like he had the better of Pogacar in the mountains, apart from that one stage, and it was pretty marginal. You know, it was very close, really. And we had we had our audio diarists, of course, and we've just released a friend special with all their best bits and the end bits, so their thoughts at the end of the tour. And Tom Southern, the sports director at EF, is very interesting on. You know, how Pogacar was able to win it and how Roglic, I suppose, was able to lose it. And in the end, probably losing that time on the crosswind stage enabled Pogacar to win the race.
I think a lot of people felt that, yeah.
Yeah, it meant his team was never put under any pressure. They never really had to do anything. And, you know, Roglic probably never felt the need to really capitalize on the strength of his team in a way. You know, he might just have been forced to race it, and his team might have been forced to race it a bit differently had Pogacar been closer.
Yes, absolutely. You would have it struck me over the last few days that you would have a hard time persuading someone who didn't know anything about cycling and had never watched a tour, who watched that race, of the importance of teams. It would be quite difficult to build an argument for Pogacar's team being crucial to him winning the race. But they obviously, there was obviously a lot of work that went unseen by the Pogacar's sort of guard dogs, the Rouleurs, so Lengen, Marcato, I guess probably even Christophe as well. But otherwise, yeah, he managed to position himself on Jumbo-Visma, on Roglic's, on Rog's shoulder, and just sneak around him at the last moment. It kind of, in the way that we thought and maybe hoped that was the only possibility for Thibaut Pinot to win the Tour, to not expose himself to any of the pressure and maybe take the jersey on the Planche de Belfi on the penultimate day. But
yeah, I think but Pinot even more than Pogacar is a known entity, isn't it? And he wouldn't probably have been allowed to ride in the way that Pogacar did. I mean, Pogacar finished third at the Vuelta, so people should have been afraid of him. But I get what you're saying about the team and element, and it wasn't a very good argument for a strong team in a way, but it's all about how you use your team as well. I mean, I've always said you need the strongest rider as well as the strongest team, ideally. And if you don't, if the strongest rider's on another team, then Francois described Pogacar as the stone in the shoe for Jumbo-Visma, and that's pretty much what he was. But I think Pogacar would struggle to win the Tour again in a similar way.
Yeah.
You know, he's done it now, but that's going to be a hard trick to repeat. They're going to have to reinforce, and you know, if he'd been in the yellow jersey, for example, or if they'd been on the back foot, then Pogacar would have been doomed. You know, a strong team is helpful is when you're in trouble, and you know, if you need a you know, help getting back on, or if you're caught in a group that needs to chase, then that's when you need a strong team.
And I think when you've been clearly identified as the main rival and as the big threat. I mean, this was a tour that in some ways reminded me a bit of 2011 when Cadel Evans, you know, I'm not saying that he won the tour without a team, but his team was very much focused on the flat part of the race, the early part of the race, and in the mountains he was left to fend for himself a lot of the time. But he managed to capitalise on the work of other teams, mainly because there were a lot of guys to watch, and there were a lot of, you know, you didn't, the winner could have come from three or four or five different guys, and in some ways that was the case with this year's tour. You know, there were a lot of guys close together and there wasn't an obvious threat, and I don't think Jumbo-Visma were getting in the bus every morning having their briefing and talking mainly or solely about Pogacar. They were talking about, you know, a lot of different people. But, you know, I think maybe Jumbo-Visma showed some inexperience. I think if Rog had maybe already won three or four or five Grand Tours, then he would have known that in order to be sure and in order to be secure, they almost should have, the red lights should have been flashing from long before, when he only had a minute over Pogacar or less than a minute. He was in great danger at that point, and they needed to do something. They needed to, you know, not just maintain status quo, but try something. You know, and it's easy to speculate as well about what difference maybe Kreiswijk being there, and also Doom, if they'd managed to keep Dumoulin high up in the general classification. I mean, I was actually thinking about this yesterday. I think the one guy who really could have been the thorn in the side to the others, if they'd managed to keep him up there early in the race, was Sepp Kuss, because he was the guy who in the mountains looked capable of possibly even going away, as well as Pogacar.
He went away by mistake on the Col de l'Alpe at one point.
He did, but he'd unfortunately lost a lot of time. Well, he'd put in a big effort on the crosswind day to Lavaux, and then he'd lost time. He was tired, and he'd lost time on the first day in the Pyrenees, so he was taken out of the equation as a GC threat. So,
it was funny, isn't it? Because initially, Jumbo-Visma, you know, months ago were talking about having three leaders at the Tour, and then very quickly it became one for all and all for one in a way. It was all, you know, Roglic became the focal point for them quite probably too early on.
Yeah. And
not having other options probably also cost them in the end.
And again, Rich, you know, this is sort of armchair quarterbackism, very easy after the fact, but just talking about thinking about Pogacar and his team, there was a time in the middle of the race when they were incredibly vulnerable because they had no mountain domestiques left. Formolo had just gone out of the race. He'd broken his collarbone. Aru had gone, and De La Cruz was still in a bad way. Oh, and they had Jan Polanc was the only domestique of any description. So this is sort of as the race was coming back towards the Alps through the Massif Central. So that day in particular on the Puy Mary and the Grand Colombier, if there was a time to sort of kill off Pog or try to kill him off by killing off his team, then it was probably on those stages. But I had the impression that Jumbo-Visma's that they were delighted to have the yellow jersey at that point, and there was no great urgency to gain more time. Although they were still dominating the race and they were still on the front for big portions of the stage, they didn't look like a team that was sort of panicking about anyone or anything in particular. But when with hindsight, you could say maybe they should have been.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, reminding us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by the next generation Watt bike Atom. Now, Watt bike sponsored all of our Tour de France coverage, and before the tour got underway, I was able to test the new Atom at home. Over the past 3 weeks, we've heard from riders who've used the Watt bike to transform their training, recover from injury, or track their improvements with the Watt bike Hub app. Now, the Watt bike Atom's been slightly redesigned with its new electromagnetic resistance system. It's even smoother to ride than before. And whether you're using an app like Zwift or Trainer Road or following a session on the Watt bike Hub, the gear changes are quick and the ride feel and accuracy of the data is better than ever. But the thing that really appeals to me about the Watt bike Atom is that it's a specific piece of equipment designed to do a specific job. There's no time spent putting your bike on the trainer or taking wheels out before and after a session. And crucially, well, something that's important to me is that you're not putting wear and tear on your own bikes while riding indoors. The new Watt bike Atom is available now from £90 per month. And if you buy now, you'll get access to some extended trials from some of the leading training and racing apps, including the Sufferfest, Full Gas, Trainer Road and Training Peaks. So to buy a Watt bike Atom from £90 per month, or just to find out more about it, go to wattbike.com. That's wattbike.com.
And Daniel, what do you make of the Tour champion then, Pogacar? I mean, one of the curious things about taking the jersey right at the end like that is we spent all Tour not talking about him an awful lot, not really getting to know him, you know, not telling his story to the audience. I guess you had the same issue. And he's still new as far as a lot of people are concerned. I saw him, you know, I saw news reports declaring him an unknown Slovenian wins Tour de France. That was the way that the news was kind of received. But we've been talking about Pog for a while, and he, I guess, ever since he turned pro, he's looked to be a kind of phenomenon. His third at the Vuelta last year was, you know, breaking new ground for him, and again he looked really strong towards the end of the week. We had an interview with Jeroen Swart, his team doctor, in our podcast, in our final podcast from the Tour, who talked about his powers of recovery and his physiology a bit. But you know what did you make of him in terms of how he came across, how he grew into that role? He didn't have long to grow into it, but did you see any signs of growth into that role? And you know, is he Jan Ullrich or Eddy Merckx, I suppose?
Well, he's a bit of a Rubik's Cube, isn't he? I mean, I fought this battle last year on the Vuelta to try and sort of tease and eke any sort of colourful detail out of him or about him out. And, you know, I came up with one thing over the course of the three weeks. That was the fact that he was reading The Godfather and, you know, tried to prod him with this in the mix zone to get a bit of a laugh or a joke out of him and had great difficulty. And it was the same this year. You know, we spoke to him a lot and all the sort of TV crews, and he's a bit of a mystery, and not someone that really transmits any joie de vivre or joie de like pedale, you know, love of what he's doing, which evidently is there. And you know, you speak to people in the team, I mean, particularly before the mountain stages, I understand that he was very sort of exuberant in the bus in the morning. He was sort of the one guy on there who was clearly, you know, not just expectant but excited about, you know, what the day would bring. But we don't really get much of that. And, you know, it's interesting the parallel you draw with Ulrich, because, you know, Ulrich won his 97 tour by almost 10 minutes. But that was a different era when there were long time trials and we saw these huge margins. So it was a crushing display in a manner that we don't really see them anymore. But, you know, there... In 1997, all the talk was about how many was going to win, and I haven't really seen any of that about Pogacar. Although that's almost the natural question to ask, you know, a 21-year-old winning the tour, which is, you know, hasn't happened, or he's the youngest winner since 1904, isn't he? You would think that the conversation would automatically turn to that. You know, how long is his reign going to be? Is it going to be 10 years? Is it going to be 5 years? Because that's what people were saying about Ulrich.
Yeah, there isn't really any of that. Maybe that's because there are so many others out there. I mean, Bernal, you know, still so young himself, and Remco Evenepoel as well.
Yeah,
there's a little gathering of youngsters.
It's interesting, Rich. I remember saying in the pod a few months ago, when we were talking about these guys, and I said at the time, it's difficult to imagine now, but in a very short space of time, maybe within a year or 18 months or 2 years, one of these guys we're talking about, and might have thrown Van der Poel in there, one of them will probably already be viewed as a disappointment, because one of them won't have, you know, they can't all have won the next three Tour de France's. And as soon as, you know, one of them finishes second or third, then they risk falling into that sort of Ulrich category, or that Ulrich conversation, whereby you start to get viewed through the prism of disappointment and underachievement, and that in itself can start to condition people's, you know, the way they live their lives as professionals and the way they train, and you know, they get into a sort of cycle of repetitive failure. And, you know, I don't want to suggest that's going to be the case with Bernal, but it's amazing how quickly things have turned.
But then what I thought about that, even when you talked there about Pogacar's exuberance, because it's easy being the challenger, and much harder being the champion, as Bernal found out this year. I mean, I thought the way that Bernal responded to that showed a sort of strength of character and personality that probably stands him in good stead. You know, he seemed to still be, despite his injury, which eventually caused him to pull out, enjoying being there and enjoying the racing. And maybe this year is a blip because of the nature of the season, the way that riders have prepared for it. You know, there's been some interesting stuff this week from Pogacar's coach about how he had to be held back at times during the period when there was no racing. You know, who knows what will happen next year, but as you say, that for all these guys, they're still on a steep upward trajectory. The challenge, the difficult part, comes when that flattens out or dips, and that's when you find out what somebody's made of. And I would suggest that the signs of Bernal are pretty good. You know, he seemed to respond in a pretty level-headed way to what happened to him.
Yeah, I mean, he was very impressive in the interviews he gave to us, and he was very honest and, you know, very noble, and you know, I thought he did himself great credit in the way he dealt with everything. I really thought that he had to shoulder a huge burden for Ineos as well, in terms of being their public face and being their storyteller as well. I mean, he was the guy who was, you know, giving the most interviews for the team. There wasn't a charismatic, you know, a Nicolas Portal who used to almost fulfil that role. And he was almost the filter through which, you know, what was happening on the bus would be conveyed to the media, and he would sort of set the tone the publicly for the team. And Bernal was almost having to do that for Ineos, I thought, which, you know, at 23 as the defending champion is quite some burden. Richard, we also think about, you know, career trajectories and facing up to this, well, sort of image of being a success or a failure, and how that can affect people. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how Rog now deals with the disappointment. Roglic, you know, his career has been, well, it's been all flowers really up until this point. You know, he's had huge success in a short amount of time, and you know, I think one of the things that made the time trial so poignant was just the sort of implicit knowledge that you know, he's 31 and Pogacar's 10 years younger. And for Rog, you know, this might be, looking at the powers that are emerging, this might have been the one and only opportunity. And, you know, again, you talk about dignity and dealing with things in a very noble way. I mean, he's someone as well who doesn't necessarily give a lot, and people have called him robotic. And there was this great line in L'Equipe from Alex Roos, the writer, who said that he'd appeared as engaging as a refrigerator thus far in the tour. But I think there's also something quite refreshingly stoic about him. You know, he's someone who's not, doesn't seem to be interested in the trappings of, you know, 21st century superstardom. He's not on social media, or he doesn't really use social media a great deal. And, you know, I thought the way he dealt with that defeat, was quite impressive, really, and will have won a lot of people's affection.
Oh, absolutely. I think Roglic came out of it very well, in the sense that he dealt with his, what must have been a huge disappointment, with great dignity, and also on the final stage into Paris and on the podium, very, very gracious indeed. Just going back briefly to Bernal, the point you make about him being the team spokesman, that was another element of the gamble in not taking Froome and Thomas, wasn't it? Because they would have absorbed a lot of attention.
Absolutely. That was noticeable.
And taken on that, you know, shouldered that burden, I suppose. And so it left an awful lot. I mean, it struck me that Ineos team, there was a lot of experience in it, but the three riders who were potentially leaders were, you know, Bernal, Carapaz and Sivakov, had two Tours de France between them, you know, and they were both both in Bernal's legs. And that was another aspect of the gamble that I probably didn't properly consider before the tour. But yeah, Roglic, he's probably still got time, in the sense that he came to the sport quite late, and you tend to imagine that he's not got as many miles on the clock as some other 31-year-olds. You know, Dumoulin, for example, not much younger, and a sense with Dumoulin of almost reaching the end of the road, in a sense, in terms of his sort of a motivation. He talked about thinking about quitting, and you know, you get the sense that there's maybe not the same hunger in Dumoulin as there is in Roglic.
No.
And as Richie Port, you know, the example of Richie Port shows, you know, and indeed Cadel Evans, who tried for many years before he finally got his win at the Tour. Roglic could be, I don't see him kind of losing his way. I think he'll dust himself down and probably by the winter be, you know, more committed than ever to achieving his goal. I don't know. I can't see him losing his way.
No, I don't think from a psychological point of view you will. I think from a technical point of view there's a slight issue which has been shown up a few times now. You know, Matt White spoke to me at the start of the tour about his vulnerability in the final time trial, that, you know, there's a bit of a pattern with him. I think Froome mentioned it as well when he spoke on ITV about, you know, this last time trial being a problem for Roglic. And he tends to, don't even notice, but he has this very high cadence, and it seems to be accentuated as the race goes on, and there seems to be less and less power there, but he maintains the cadence, and it always looks as though he's finding it harder and harder to sort of make the difference. The punch whereby he, you know, nicks away and gets the, you know, in the last kilometre of mountain stages and takes stage wins and gets bonus seconds, that seems to desert him slightly. And, you know, where he's going to get that from, particularly, as I say, with these younger riders who are only going to get better, them coming up behind him, I just worry slightly, you know, how confident are Jumbo-Visma? They've built this huge sort of armada now. How confident are they going to be that they've backed the right horse in the long term? And they haven't got anyone sort of waiting in the wings. You know, among all their strong riders, they're three riders who are closer to the end than they are the start. And I just wonder whether they're going to start looking to groom someone. If they see this as their future as a Grand Tour team, then I think they need to maybe start that process.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. First came on board in 2016 at the Giro d'Italia, and they'll be supporting us at another Giro d'Italia in a week's time, weirdly. Weirdly that the Giro's happening in October, but we'll get onto that in a moment. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. Daniel, you were wondering where the next, whether Jumbo Visma would be better off backing a young rider. Well, the 2017 Tour de l'Avenir winner won the Tour last year. The 2018 Tour de l'Avenir winner won the Tour this year. And the 2019 Tour de l'Avenir winner, who should win the Tour next year by that logic, Tobias Foss, he is on Jumbo Visma's books and he is riding the Giro d'Italia next week. But I'm not sure he's a Tour winner. Let's see, shall we? We might find out a bit more at the Giro d'Italia. Just one other thing on Pogacar before we look ahead briefly to the World Championships. Inevitably, perhaps, there's, you know, sort of suspicion accompanies impressive performances, and especially, you know, the way that Pogacar won that final time trial. I mean, his performances generally seem to have given rise to a certain amount of speculation about whether his performances are credible. And also, I guess that suspicion comes a little bit from some of the people involved in his team, UAE Team Emirates.
Yes, Rich. I mean, I don't know how much you saw in the French press, but there was a low murmur which became louder and louder as the tour went on. There were interviews with people who, you know, to be honest, are not really connected with professional cycling in any great way anymore. So there was one with Stefan Urlo, which got quite a lot of airplay. And Stefan Urlo, former yellow jersey wearer in the Tour de France and former team manager sort of saw Jason, the French pro Conti team. He made some fairly strong remarks about Pogacar, and not just Pogacar, also Wout van Aert and other people, and Romain Feuillu as well, former yellow jersey wearer, I think, I'm not mistaken. Remember that, Rich?
Yeah, a
sprinter, also rode in some minor French teams for the majority of his career and now retired. He also expressed some doubts about Pogacar and others. On the one hand, I think some of the individuals involved at UAE Emirates kind of deserve the scrutiny. Mauro Gianetti he rode in the 90s and has got a fairly nebulous record, I would say, is to be quite kind, on all matters doping. He was heavily involved. Well, he was the team manager of Sornier Duval, the sort of disgraced Sornier Duval team between, there was a very dark period in that team's history, which ultimately culminated in the team closing. So in 2008, they had Ricardo Rico in the Tour de France, who was kicked out for doping. They had Iban Mayo, who was caught for doping. Juan Jose Cobo as well, the Vuelta winner in 2011, who was then later stripped of that title. And Gianetti really pays the price for never having explicitly said what he did as a rider and never having really clearly addressed what was going on in his team in those years, 2006 2008. So you know, the image that the general public has is of someone who at best has an ambiguous stance on doping, and his sort of right hand man is a guy, Machin Fernandez, who was at MAPE. He was the talent scout, very very successful talent scout for De Koenig Quickstep a few years ago, but then in the last 3 or 4 years has been reunited with Gianetti, who he worked with a lot, including Sornier Duval. He's sort of the guy, he's the reason really that Pogacar ended up on that team, because in the period when he was working as a talent scout for De Koenig Quickstep, he had a very close eye on under 23 races and Espoir races, and that's where he first saw Pogacar. And I think he made contact with Pogacar's family, and they were certainly on that case very early. But so they're two individuals that people ask questions about. There's the issue of Pogacar's performances, also the fact that he didn't have a long record of huge success as a junior. His last year as an under 23, he was very successful, but you have to balance that with also the fact that he was in a small Slovenian team, so Rog Ljubljana, and they weren't necessarily doing the big international under 23 races or junior races. So his emergence, his rise has been kind of meteoric and very fast. For balance again, there are other individuals in UAE Emirates who I think people can justifiably have a lot of confidence in. Alan Piper was Pogacar's main domestique during the Tour de France. He was his main director sportif during the Tour de France. Someone who I think, has been pretty honest and upfront about doping, not just when he was a rider, but also as a director sportif. The medical staff there, you know more about them than me, Rich. Headed up by Jeroen Swartz, someone who's been heavily involved in anti-doping in South Africa. And the head of performances in Yigo Sam Mian, who was also actually involved at Sornier de Val, but more recently has been better known as someone with quite a strong position vis-a-vis doping and anti-doping, and worked at Garmin, and so it's quite a jumbled picture, and again it's always fraught with peril anyway, judging basements about a rider on simply who else is in his team, who are the people around him, because cycling doesn't work in quite the way that it did 20 or 30 years ago, when director sportifs and some were administering and masterminding doping programs. And then the other thing, Rich, which we've said many times over the last two or three years, is that it's just very difficult to get a clear picture of what's going on as far as doping is concerned in professional cycling at the moment, in the absence of major cases. People can point to the Adelas operation in Austria, and also with links to Slovenia, but the main evidence in that case and the individuals involved it points to quite a few years ago now, and again doesn't necessarily shed that much light on it doesn't shed any light really on new techniques that might be used and might be undetectable and that might be sort of commonplace in the peloton at the moment. So it's very difficult to know. And then the other strand to it, I suppose, is the performances, and people will draw conclusions just on things like climbing times and so on. But if someone had said at the start of the Tour de France, well, a guy is going to finish 3 minutes ahead of Richie Porte on the general classification, is that by definition going to be suspicious? And I don't necessarily think they would say that it was, or it was going to be.
No, that's a very good point. And I think also I mentioned lockdown and the absence of racing. As I mentioned, Jeroen Swartz interview, the head doctor at UAE Team Emirates, well worth listening to if you didn't catch that in our final episode from the Tour de France. But he's spoken in the past to me about riders commonly being overtrained, and that being one of the biggest issues facing professional cyclists: overtraining, over racing as well. And if nothing else, having sort of 4 or 5 months of no racing, riders may at this tour have been in better condition than ever before, because they've been able to manage or have their training managed better than before. I think there are other aspects of the period that we've just been through that would count against good performance as well. So it's a bit of a ledger, but I think
Just in terms of that issue of freshness and being overtrained, Rich, I spoke to, as I'm sure you guys did, and listened to a number of riders talk about this during the tour, and one comment that Adam Yates made to me stood out. He said that he really noticed it In particularly sort of sprinting out of corners and roundabouts and so on, there was a sort of level of explosiveness which was superior to the norm, which, you know, that sort of tallies really when you talk to physiologists about what happens to a rider's body in the Tour de France. They will say that they get fitter, you know, aerobically, but they become less explosive, and so, you know, freshness and kind of explosiveness go together. So I think there probably was a bit of a qualitative difference this year due to that.
And again, if you know, the audio diaries that we had 9 riders keeping diaries. They all talked about the level. Michael Morkov, especially in the final installment of that, talked about the super high level this year. But that includes him. You know, I mean, he was one of those riders. I think they were all, a lot of them found that the level of their competitors was very high, but also their own level was very high. And it seems to have been a very fast and hard Tour de France from that point of view. And I think also what was impressive about it was, we talked about this a lot, that there don't seem to be any soft breaks anymore. You know, there was one kind of, in inverted commas, boring day, but there weren't long breakaways of you know, 3 or 4 French teams or wildcard teams just putting men up the road and having them reeled in gradually by the bunch. Every stage, the breaks were tough to get into. They often included really strong riders, and teams who didn't have overall ambitions or didn't have a sprinter had real well thought out plans for how to try and win the stage or have an impact on the stage. I mean, Sunweb most obviously with their 3 stage wins, but it was a really interesting tour from that point of view. I didn't think there was a single boring stage.
Just one final remark on the tour, Rich, and this is something that hit the agenda on the last day, was the issue of the Black Lives Matter movement and Kevin Razor, and how what was done, what wasn't done on the last day. So I got a message from Torn ASO actually early on the last day saying that Razor was going to be on the front line of the peloton that day with the jersey wearers and lead the race out from a suburb of Paris, in which I don't think he was born there, but he spent a lot of his youth there, didn't he? I think, or it was very close to where he spent a lot of his youth. So it was also symbolic in that sense. And I mean, it was a small gesture. I think I spoke to him a couple of times during the tour, including that day, and he agreed that it was a small gesture. But I was slightly, you know, you're slightly dismayed sometimes to see the reaction publicly, particularly on social media, to, you know, a small move, a small gesture in the right direction. And, you know, it immediately turns into sort of accusations towards kind of ASO about what's not been done and what they should have been doing before that. And, I thought about it a lot over the next few days, and as I said, having spoken to Kevin Razor, and you know, one thing I do think, and it was brought home to me again at this year's Tour de France, just watching the Tour and being at the Tour, was how the Tour really projects an image of France that's outdated, or it's a Tour de rural France, which is, you know, not the whole of France. It doesn't represent the whole of France. France has the biggest ethnic minority population in Europe by some distance, actually. I think getting on for 10%, whereas, you know, countries like Italy, it's closer to 1 or 2%. And this is not really represented by the Tour de France, but it's not also reflected by the places that the Tour goes to. The Tour, you know, it does predominantly visit rural places, and the image that you get of France is very quaint and cutesy, and you know, there's bunting and there's, you know, garlic, and it's a real sort of cliched image of France, but there is no celebration of a more diverse France. You know, I mean, I spoke to Kevin Razor about how in 1998, I remember I was living in France and France won the Football World Cup, and there was this term was coined, the bleu, blanc, beurre, as a blue, white, and basically beurre is kind of a word the French use for sort of immigrant populations, immigrant communities. And, you know, this was celebrated because it was a team, you know, with Algerian immigrants or Senegalese immigrants or sort of the descendants of Senegalese immigrants and you know, from people from Guadeloupe, the former, well, the current, even the current colonies. And then, you know, France got sort of felt very, you know, proud of this very diverse team. And you don't see any of that in the Tour de France, that in the image of France that the Tour de France conveys. And then, you know, I did think that in the spirit of just making a move in that direction, which I think ultimately commercially is going to be important for the Tour one day, you know, it's going to have to start reflecting what real France is like. I think, you know, they could involve Kevin Reiser in an ambassadorial role, and he's someone who, you know, I don't think he felt patronized by what was done on the last day, and he's, you know, someone who speaks well, and he is a great ambassador. You know, so he's probably someone who from B&B Hotels, his team earns 100,000 or 150,000 a year. You know, ASO could, I'm sure, could afford to pay him 50,000 a year to do 50 days of kind of ambassadorial work, in whereby, you know, he travels around maybe with Christian Prudhon for, as I say, 50 days a year, and he does, you know, help the Tour to make a move in the direction of representing a more real, a more diverse, and a more modern France. And I don't know if you've, I mean, you're living there now, Rich, but, you know, when you...
I'm living in very rural France.
Well, well, exactly, indeed. But yeah. you know how different those two images are. Of that France versus, you know, the France that's represented by the French football team and the France that you see in cities. And you know, it's very easy for the Tour to get by and to survive and to feel very comfortable in the image that it's always had of rural France. But, you know, when I think of sponsorship and being completely cynical and practical about it, when you consider that companies like Nike and Adidas have sort of nibbled around the edges of professional cycling and then withdrawn ultimately in several cases. I mean, they have a very sort of token presence in professional cycling now. You know, part of the reason for that is that that the sort of rural aging population is not their target market. And
I mean, this is such a tricky subject, this, and whenever we discuss it on the podcast, we always get a lot of reaction from people angry about something that we've said, unfortunately, and we get I've noticed as well a lot of people presuming to think for Kevin Reiser and be angry on his behalf when he's the only guy that we speak to on this subject. I mean, he isn't, but inevitably he, at the Tour de France, as the only black rider there, became a bit of a spokesman for this issue. Now, one of the debates is that fair? Should it not be up to the other riders to address this issue and try to change things as well? And of course, it should be. And, you know, I thought we had a bit of background on exactly how that protest came about on the final day of the Tour from Lionel in the last podcast from the Tour. And that, you know, there are riders like TJ Van Garderen was very much pushing for all the riders of the Tour to make some kind of statement and take a stance. It was interesting that Reiser himself mentioned Matteo Trentin, who's quite sort of politically aware and, you know, interested in issues beyond just riding his bike fast.
And also, Rich hails from a town down the road from Gianni Moscon's town.
Who is obviously featured in this discussion in another context, having racially abused Kevin Reiser a few years ago. So I get the feeling that even that little and inadequate protest on the final day of the Tour, I think it's woken a few people up or got them thinking. And maybe guys like Trentin, who are kind of senior figures in the bunch, it will be up to people like that to make it more meaningful and a bit more impactful the next time. But you know, everything starts with one step, doesn't it? And this was the Tour's first acknowledgement, or the rider's first real acknowledgement of this issue that's such a defining issue in the world and in sport. And cycling and does seem to lag behind.
Yeah, I do think it's just better to applaud and commend, you know, an organisation like the Tour for belatedly perhaps doing something and not having done enough, than to, you know, focus on and condemn what they haven't done in the past and alienate them.
Well, if you try to do something and you're criticised for doing it, you're unlikely to try to do it again.
And Rich, the immediate imperative for the Tour, for ASO, is not there because cycling, you know, and they've contributed to this, but cycling is a very white sport. So they get, when they go, you know, out into France, they get the image, you know, reflected back that they've, you know, also been conveying for a long period of time. But they don't, you know, when you go into rural France, you're not confronted with the issue of, you know, if every fourth face at the roadside was a black face, then they would, you know, they would immediately, it would be glaringly obvious to everyone that there's something very wrong. But when they go out, you know, to places like La Rochelle and wherever it was this year, and every face on the roadside is a white face, then it's a lot easier to feel very complacent that, you know, you're reflecting your own demographic and you're in tune with your own demographic. But, you know, I think take the morality out of it and the politics out of it, just purely commercially, I think that it would be in their interest to start moving in that direction. I know very similar arguments have been made about ASO and women's cycling as well.
Absolutely. Complacency is certainly the word, yes. And, you know, there was the stage that started in Bagatelle in Toulouse last year, which was a nod to a different
very cursory nod, wasn't it?
And let's not deny,
I mean, one feature of the Tour de France this year, and it is every year, but speaking to people who watch it on TV, the star of the Tour this year in many ways was the drone shots and the helicopter shots of an absolutely just mind-blowingly beautiful country. And you know, if you can imagine instead the Tour decides that actually, you know, we're not going to have those stages anymore through the verdant, you know, the volcanoes of Auvergne and so on and so forth.
We're going to have a crit in Lyon.
Yeah, you know, the sort of gnarliest parts of Lyon. Then, yeah, it's uncomfortable, you know. But
I say Lyon because I went for a bike ride in Lyon thinking I could reach the countryside, and I couldn't actually from where we were staying. And it wasn't very nice. It wasn't very nice at all. And that is the side of France that exists, but you don't see on the Tour de France. I'm not sure they would want you to see. Shall we move on briefly to the World Championships, Daniel? Very briefly, because we're going to be overtaken by events. Let's hear first, actually, from Mads Pedersen, who I spoke to at the Tour, about his year, or, you know, not a full year in terms of racing, but his year in the rainbow jersey.
Yeah, it's out of my hands, so I have no feelings about it. It's how it is. The world is in a bad position right now, and I shouldn't cry about not having too many days in a rainbow jersey. You know, people have a worse time than me, so life is not too bad. I just enjoy every time I can put the jersey on. I go for a ride almost every day, so of course I enjoy the moments every day I can put the rainbow stripes on. And yeah, now I'm gonna enjoy my last four race days in the jersey and the last week of training, and then hopefully another good guy who will take over, hopefully a Danish.
Do you think you'll feel emotional on Sunday in Paris wearing it for the last time in a race?
If I win, yes.
Well, I was gonna say, I mean, you must fancy that stage, do you?
Yeah, the sprinting is going quite well for me, and after hard stages like this, I think the sprint in Paris fits me quite okay. Of course, I'm not a super sprinter, but everything can happen in Paris, and with the lead-out train I have here with Toms, Edvard and Jasper, I think it's possible.
I mean, you won a stage in Poland, of course. How did it feel to cross the line first in that jersey?
It was a big relief. Like you said, we didn't have a lot of opportunities this year, not too many race days, so at least to have one win in the jersey was really nice.
And after the Tour, what are the big targets for you? I'm guessing the classics, but is there anyone in particular that you fancy?
No, right now we just have to go fast whenever we're racing, so it's the classics.
So that was Mads Pedersen. There'll be a new wearer of the rainbow jersey sometime tomorrow. Who's going to win it, Daniel?
Oh, I think Wout van Aert will probably win it. Do you not think?
Yeah, I guess so.
Pog?
Yeah.
I don't think it's not hard enough for Pog, is it? It'd be nice if Rog won it.
Pog said he wants Rog to win it.
That'd be a lovely story, wouldn't it?
It would be lovely. Well, we're not big on speculation, are we? So,
let's leave the speculation and let them focus.
There's a lot of climbing in the course, isn't there?
Yes. I don't really like the chance. I was looking at Italy's team the other day and, Nibali's had a bit of a dip. Going on what people said about the way he was riding in Tirreno Adriatico, I mean, he was going very well at the start of the season, then came out of lockdown, I think, pretty well. But he's had a bit of a dip, so I didn't really see where a win was going to come from the Italian team. But now they probably will. They'll probably prove me wrong, make me look like a fool.
Probably. Well, let's watch it and then come back and discuss that with Lionel at the start of the week. As I mentioned earlier, a new Friends of the Podcast episode is out. That is all the audio diaries from the Tour de France with their kind of final thoughts on the race. Really, there's some really great stuff in there, and it's been wonderfully well put together by Adam Bowie, who's also producing this episode. Sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. There'll be an episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminar coming out Monday with Lizzie Banks's audio diary from the Giro Rosa. On Tuesday, we'll be back with Lionel discussing the road race world championships. And then, starting on October the 3rd, we'll have the grandest tour. 5 weeks of daily episodes featuring the Giro d'Italia, the Classics, and the Vuelta a España. Daniel and I are off to the Giro, off to Palermo next week on Friday. We'll convene there. And over 5 weeks, first time we've done this, a mix of race coverage and analysis, interviews, and Kilometre Zero episodes. So tune in for that. But that's all from us for today. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Rich.